closer.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Pre-Accident Podcast. This is it. You found it. I'm your host. I'm Todd Conklin, and we're going to hang out for the next half hour or so. Thanks for tuning in or listening or downloading or whatever it is you putting your speakers into your ear holes or whatever it is you do to listen to a podcast. I appreciate it. I know your time is money, and I know you don't have a lot of either, and I know that every second you take is a second away from other crap you could be doing, but nonetheless, I really, really appreciate you listening. And thanks for subscribing. And tell your friends, because telling your friends seems to make a big difference, and it's working. One of the cool things that's happening with this podcast is that now people are wanting to be on the podcast because it's the place to be to talk about this new safety. That's great. They call me and they write me emails and they say, I got a new book. I got this. I got that. Either way, it's great. I welcome them all because I think more voices, more opinions, more ideas helps us in our discussion for sort of a new way to look at and manage reliable performance in high-risk systems, which is what all of you do. Every single one of you do that. Some of you higher risk than others, but nonetheless, whether you're an airline pilot and there are a lot of you listening, or whether you run a mine or you work in a plant or whatever you do, it's high-risk work and your people are too dang valuable to actually risk their lives to get the work done. And that's kind of what today's podcast is going to talk about. It's been a great week. Lots of fun. Last week's podcast was amazing. I think you're going to find this week's even more amazing. Now, there's some I haven't talked about, and I just haven't brought it up because I wanted to wait until the perfect time, and now it's the perfect time. A couple months ago, Lufthansa had a German wing plane fly into the side of a mountain. And I know you followed this story, although I met a guy last week that heard nothing about it. That was pretty remarkable. He told me he spends most of his life 300 feet below ground in a mine, and he doesn't get much news. So I was with him. Nonetheless, we had a 27-year-old co-pilot with less than 600 hours experience on the piece of equipment flying an Airbus A320 who basically flew it into the side of a mountain. And the way he did it is he encouraged the pilot to leave to go to the bathroom. When the pilot left, he barricaded the door, set the altimeter to 100 feet, and watched the plane progressively go to its demise. Horrible. Horrible, horrible, terrible. 149 people were murdered, and one person committed suicide. Now, as students of a more systems approach to understanding reliability, I hope you thought about this, because I did, because this one's really interesting. Let's start here. The defense we put in to keep the pilot and co-pilot safe from bad guys was the very defense that became the problem when the bad guys on the inside of the door and the good guys on the outside of the door. The defense we created to keep bad guys out also keeps good guys out. And we should have thought of that, and perhaps we did think of it, but in this case, the people on that plane could do absolutely nothing but watch that plane plow into the ground. And that's bad. And it became really clear really fast, and they were very quick with this information, that the co-pilot was suicidal. Now, you'd think that would be the answer to this story, and what scares me so much is that I'm afraid that is the answer to the story, but I don't think it's enough. The question I would ask is not how could a suicidal pilot fly a plane into the side of a mountain. That actually strikes me as relatively easy. In fact, you don't even have to do much except adjust the altimeter, and there you go. The question I hope you're thinking of as a student of the new view is how could our systems be so brittle that an inexperienced 27-year-old pilot with significant mental health issues can kill 149 other people in broad daylight in front of every air traffic controller and a qualified pilot who's on the other side of the door? That question is what we're going to tackle today. And to do that, we're going to talk to a guy named Mark McElhaney. Now, Mark is a great guy. He's a psychologist that specializes in violence. he's in a crossroads, and he's at a crossroads with us. I've worked with Mark lots and lots for a really, really big companies. I don't know if I'm supposed to say the name of the companies, but that's how I met Mark. In fact, at the end of the podcast, I'll tell you exactly how I met Mark. Mark's going to talk to you about the place where mental health and safety meets. And I don't think there's a better illustration of that than the Germanwings crash. Is workplace violence an HR problem? Is it a security problem? Is it an occupational medicine problem? Or is it a safety problem? And I think Mark's going to give us an answer. And the answer is going to be all three. Listen carefully to Mark. He is probably the best in the world at understanding and providing early prevention to potential workplace violence issues. This podcast is interesting. Without any further ado, here's Dr. Mark McElhaney and our conversation.
Shoot it. Let's go.
So tell us about yourself. What do you do that's so interesting to a bunch of people who sit around and think about how systems influence behavior and how to get performance so it's more reliable? What do you bring to the table, young Dr. Mark McElhaney?
Gosh, those are words that we don't use too much, Todd, but I will try my best. Actually, as you know, I'm a psychologist by background, and what I do is we specialize in what we call threat assessment, or in the area of workplace violence, which essentially is that we get called in when companies are experiencing a potential high-risk situation, such as workplace violence, someone who may become violent, they're about to fire somebody and they're worried about them, or they just have someone who's acting a little funny and they're just nervous about it. So we go in. Our core services is we go in and advise companies, help them assess what the threat is and help to get it to safe conclusion. The way you and I think, overlap over the last few years is that as we've done this over the years, we've pretty much figured out the point that they're actually worrying about someone killing someone else and calling us in at the last minute, you know, because we pretty much have understood at this point that violence is not just an act that happens out of nowhere. Basically, there's a process that develops, and we usually get called in at the last minute to kind of put out the fire. So we've spent a lot of time over the last few years basically helping companies put together systemic prevention programs to help them not get to that point where they have a potentially violent individual who could cause a whole lot of harm to their workplace, not only physically harm, but in terms of disruption of productivity, you know, morale issues. I mean, you can go on and on and on. And so over time, I think we've pretty much established what companies need to have in place in order to prevent these issues.
Do you mostly work with security people, or do you work with safety people ever? How did companies see this? Because I would tell you, speaking for the people that are probably listening to this podcast, this isn't a security problem and it's not a safety problem. It's a reliability problem. It seems like it crosses everything. Does it?
Well, it does. And that's the topic of a book I'm working on right now, which is basically that traditionally companies have seen this as a security issue. Now, when I say security issue as opposed to safety issue, I'm not talking about who actually deals with it, whether it's corporate security or safety. I'm talking about the way the company approaches it. The way traditionally it's happened is that companies see this as an issue where there's danger in the workplace. They've got to call security and walk someone out the door. In other words, a reactive last-minute approach. And the problem is that's based on a certain set of assumptions, those assumptions being that somehow you can't prepare for this. Somehow these are anomalies that just happen out of nowhere, that suddenly the person shows up with a weapon in their hand and we've got to do something quick to make it safe. And what the whole theme of my next book is essentially going to be the fact that these are situations that develop within the workplace, not anomalies, not criminal types, not psychopaths, and are showing signs and symptoms and a process that the company can be aware of and have a program that identifies these people and deals with these situations early with less cost and with safer outcomes. To me, it's a safety concern. To me, it's a safety concern that's just as legitimate as as making sure you buckle your seatbelts when you ride in cars or taping the electrical cords.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, but unfortunately, I for whatever reason, it's seen as a quote-unquote security concern, which means, again, that we have a reactive law enforcement response to it. If I can give you an example, you know, in terms of if you think about Columbine, you think about Sandy Hook, if you think about the Navy Yard shooting, if you think about Virginia Tech, those are all suicidal events. Most workplace violence shootings are suicidal events. And by that, I mean that the individual who perpetrated that probably decided to commit suicide before they decided to commit homicide. If you were to, you know, diagnose or siphon out their thinking in a linear manner.
Right.
The bottom line is that 5% of our population attempts suicide in their lifetime. One out of every 20 people that are surrounding you right now will attempt suicide in their lifetime.
I had no idea. Really? The numbers are that big?
Yes, that's a fact.
Wow.
And 40% of workplace violence is domestic violence. So one out of four women in the United States, one out of four has been assaulted or sexually abused by an intimate partner, one out of four. Every year, 13,000 women are assaulted by their husbands or boyfriends in the workplace, assaulted or killed in the workplace. Because bottom line is that if a woman is trying to hide from her husband or boyfriend and is living somewhere else, he will find her at work. He knows where she works, and he will go to work. And that's where a lot of times the biggest workplace, the domestic violence events occur. So if you have one out of four women and who are assaulted by their boyfriends or whatever, often in the workplace, 13,000 a year, and you have one out of 20 people who are attempting suicide, there's no workplace that's not going to have that. In other words, that is, you're going to have suicidal people. You're going to have people who have domestic issues. And why are we waiting till the last minute when the guy shows up with a gun to decide that this is a problem and to react to it and have some and call it a security issue?
Well, talk to us about, I've not talked about this a lot on the podcast so far, partially because I was waiting for you. And partially because I think this is a pretty interesting. Talk to us about this German Wings thing. So here we have a 27-year-old co-pilot, less than 600 flight hours on the Airbus A320, waits for the pilot to leave to go to the bathroom, barricades the door, and basically drives the plane into the side of the Alps. Predictable? Manageable? What do we need to know about it? Because what scares me is that I think people are going to say, that guy was crazy, therefore this event is an anomaly. But in my mind, there's way more to this. I think the crazy part is kind of the tragic reality. The problem is that our system allowed somebody to barricade himself in a cockpit of a plane, and we can do nothing about it until he crashes the plane, the demise that 150 people had in that event.
You know, this is where your field and mine intersect in a lot of ways, because the bottom line is that you're right. First of all, just back up a minute. What's going to happen, what always happens, is people need explanations for things, easy explanations, and eventually they're going to label this guy as evil or crazy. And what that does for us is it says, oh, those things, number one, it doesn't happen often. Number two, there's nothing to do about it because there's evil and crazy people in the world. The fact is that this guy looked like everybody else in our environment. He acted like everybody else. He was a quote-unquote normal-looking person, and suddenly he causes the deaths of all these other people. And the fact is that in our – you know, we deal with hundreds of these cases every – you know, hundreds every year, probably 300 or 400 a year. And 99% of these are people that if they were sitting in the room with you right now, you wouldn't think of them. They wouldn't be looking like they're evil people or crazy people. They would look like you and me, just as like this pilot did. But this pilot was suicidal. There was a high risk factor there. And what we're talking about in workplace violence now, at least what I'm talking about, is not so much violence or you know, looking at violence, but looking at high risk behaviors. This guy had something high risk going on. He was suicidal. I don't know that we could have done a better job of finding that out or not. Probably. I haven't been reading that much about it. But the bottom line is like what you talk about all the time, which is, I believe, that you can't eliminate all adverse events. You can only manage the consequences
right. Of
those events. You cannot keep suicidal people out of your workplace. It can, you know, you're not going to be able to do that. People become suicidal. Like I said, you know, 1 out of 20 attempt suicide in their lifetime. So you're going to have that happen. Do you have systems in place that can manage the consequences of having suicidal people in your workplace? And that's kind of, I think, really kind of ends up at your doorstep in terms of what you do, you know, and what you talk about in your safety.
But in this case, the pilot, had the pilot self-recommended, had he self-identified that he was having pretty significant issues around destruction of self, he would have lost his ticket and would not have been able to fly. So it strikes me that the system, and this is where I think your work is really interesting, the system wants these people to go and self-identify as mentally unstable. But if they do self-identify as mentally unstable, the reward for that is to be removed from the workplace and to have your ability to do your job, pay your bills, make the boat payment, that goes away. It strikes me that insider threat, which is really a significant threat to these people, the systems we have to identify and help these people are really naive and simple. If you feel bad, tell somebody and we'll get you help.
Exactly. I mean, in the bottom line, at least in the United States, you know, we don't have a mental health care system to speak of. I mean, we have no safety nets. So the bottom line is that you're right. If this guy self-identifies, he's out on the street and there's no support system for him. There's nothing. I mean, again, which may describe a whole nother problem area that's got to be dealt with, too, is that, you know, taking care of people as opposed to tossing them out the door, you know, because the bottom line is, like you said, I mean, this guy would have been tossed out the door, said you're suicidal, and they'd be put somewhere and he wouldn't be able to, he would not be given the resources in order to make his life better.
God, that's interesting when you think it that way. I mean, I don't know if I've thought about it that way, but I suppose after you're about 18 years old, all the mental health support network pretty much goes away. When you're a kid, there's tons of help, right?
But no, not anymore. I mean, you know, I know here in Atlanta, we used to have four hospitals when I first started here 25 years ago for adolescents, disturbed adolescents. We have zero now.
Wow.
And it's like, because, you know, bottom line is that we don't have a system for a variety of reasons that where people can't. I mean, there's no insurances pay for hospitals anymore in this country. And the fact that you can't put people in hospitals for any length of time in this country. And I mean, the mental health system in the U.S. is a jail system primarily. I mean, there is no long term care. And, you know, and again, what happens in the workplace is that whenever someone sees someone that needs help, we send them to the employee assistance program. They come back 2 days later with a clean bill of health and we say, good, and put them back to work.
And that's they're pissed off and they're angry.
And they're right? Pissed off and angry and they haven't gotten good care. And nor do we know what happened because there's a confidential relationship. So that's a lot of what we do. Basically what we do is we're consultants of the company. So if you have an issue with somebody, then we try to help them get the care that they need in a way that really is respectful of that individual and their integrity and hopefully makes their lives better because the company benefits from that. You know, you send someone out the door send them out the door angry and confused and you toss them out on the street, you pay a price for that at certain points. By the way, I mean, I read the other day a statistic and I haven't followed up on it to see where it came from, but said that most workplace violence at terminations happen 6 months later. So, you know, the average termination workplace violence event, you know, where you terminate an employee and they come back and hurt somebody, a lot of times it's the average wait of time is 6 months later.
How does a safety manager have this conversation with his leadership?
Well, I believe that what you have to do, I think there's certain components that have to be done, you know, in order to prevent workplace violence. And first of all, you've got to have leadership on board. You've got to have leadership supporting this process. Secondly, you've got to have your critical personnel, your safety managers, your security, corporate security, HR, invested in this idea. And then eventually you're going to have to train your employees. You're going to have your employees reporting their concerns. We go into situations all the time where the first thing that we're told is that we got this new situation just happened today. And we investigate it. We start talking to people. We find out, no, this didn't just happen today. There was something going on last week. And there was something going on last month. And sometimes there's been something going on for 20 years. And everyone either denied, avoided, or just did not deal with the situation, perhaps for good reason, because they didn't know what to do, nor did they feel permitted to do anything about it. But the bottom line is that the company basically got to the point where they're in a dangerous situation because they did not do anything about. They were not sensitive to these early signs. It was not being reported. They didn't have people that were responding to these reports when they did come in. They didn't have a systemic way to address these issues early in the process. So, and it's about paying attention and taking care of each other. So, you know, to be simplistic to a certain degree.
Oh, I actually think that's we'll tell you the same thing on the safety side, is that it's the people who understand best what's going on are the people out there doing the work, and they're constantly detecting and correcting, identifying, paying attention. The question I would have, and I think it's where you are, is what do they do with this information? If leadership doesn't realize it's a problem, do they have any? If they don't have any, if they're not prepared for it, is the message real?
Exactly. I mean, it's kind of like we'll go into a situation and we'll be talking to a manager and says, "You notice anything different about this guy recently?" "Oh yeah. I mean, in the last year, he's been coming to work late. He looks drunk. He's hungover. His performance is down. He looks like he hadn't bathed or whatever." He says, "Well, what's going on with him?" "Well, I don't know." "I mean, why would you not know? I mean, why have you been, you know, what is the message that's been given to the managers here? I mean, the message should be know your employees, you know what's going on with them and know what the resources are within the company to make sure that employee's getting help." Because what happens is suddenly he shows up to work with a gun and everybody's saying, "Oh my gosh, what's going on?" And you should have been prepared for this because but your managers did not have permission or the knowledge of what to do, you know, in those situations. But to me, it's pretty simple. I mean, if you got a guy starting to come in, his performance is going down and he's starting, you know, he's coming in late and all, then that needs to be addressed at that particular moment.
Right. But sometimes those conversations are hard to have, right? It's easier to ignore it, isn't it?
Yeah, oh yeah. Well, I mean, probably the perfect example of that is what I'll call a workplace bully. You know, the guy that walks around like they've got a sign on them saying, you know, don't mess with me or else. And of course, we don't mess with them, and nobody messes with them, and everybody gives them good performance ratings, and we don't discipline him. And 20 years later, when he does act out, and he feels like he owns the place, we're brought in with a guy that feels pretty reinforced and entrenched in the workplace because everyone was afraid to deal with the situation. But you pay a price eventually.
Amazing. Amazing. So companies that have had a problem, companies that have had a workplace violent event, they understand this now, and they're probably much more preventive in nature.
Yeah, I think, well, if they have an event and they follow it up by, you know, reaching out to folks like ourselves, you know, to help them put together some programs, they do, you know, they usually are, if you can direct their increased sensitivity to do the right things, yes, the answer would be yes. But it's very easy to dismiss things and put them on the back burner too, you know. I mean, it's like, you know, we all can do that very easily. I hate to point my finger at the universities, but look at all the things that have happened at universities and colleges. It's not been my experience they've done that much. If there's any one organization that should be doing something, it's them. But again, these things are written off many times as you know, well, they just happen. And I think you mentioned one time, you said luck is a what did you say? The luck is an extremely difficult
strategy to manage.
And again, I think a lot of places just rely on, well, maybe this won't happen again.
Well, or there's a collective ignorance. They collectively choose to ignore problems that are really, really difficult, and they don't have methods by which they can manage those problems. And, right. and you see it a lot. I mean, the best example is that you can go to almost any big meeting, and there'll be something that they're choosing not to deal with today.
When we have our training, when we do have a company that buys our program, you know, we have a comprehensive kind of preventing workplace violence package program that includes employee training, employee awareness training. When we start that employee awareness, we first train the company to know how to respond to it, to any kind of reports, because once you train the employee, you're going to be flooded by reports. Your employees know stuff that will horrify you. I mean, that they don't know how to report it. Once we tell the employees what's supposed to be reported, you better watch out, because you got to be careful what you can ask for, because you're going to find out there's people in your workplace that you had no idea. And again, and so that's why we always train the leadership and the response team first, because because the employees are going to start reporting. You've got a lot of issues that have been avoided in each and every workplace that you're going to deal with someday.
Wow. So what's the strategy then? I guess maybe a better question would be is if you could talk to some leaders who work in the safety and reliability community, what advice would you give them? What should they be thinking about, and how should they be thinking about these problems?
Well, first of all, if you can think of, conceptually, think about these problems as something that every workplace is going to have, because any organization is going to have. Like I said, if 1 out of 20 people attempt suicide in the world, I mean, I know you got a great pre-employment selection process in your company, but bottom line, you're no different than anybody else. You're going to have 1 in 20 years, or something pretty close to that. So first of all, you have to accept this is human behavior. This is going to happen. This is not something that you can avoid. And put together a four-step program. I mean, it's as simple as that. First of all, establish some kind of policy about workplace violence and high-risk behavior. And secondly, train an internal threat assessment team, an interdisciplinary threat assessment team or threat management team in your company. Have identified in your company people who are responsible for the response to these reports. Ideally, should be somebody from HR, somebody from safety, somebody from security, somebody from legal, so that the information about issues, high risk issues, gets routed to one central place where you have a group that's trained to know either what to do or what the resources are to help them deal with it. Again, they don't have to know everything about responding to workplace violence, but they at least need to know what the process is and who the resources are. Then you've got to basically get your what I call critical personnel on board, HR, security managers, safety managers, all the people that are getting these reports from the employees on what their role is and how important it is and what they need to be looking out for. And then final, the fourth step is basically having some kind of employee awareness training. Like we have a video. It only lasts 15, 20 minutes that several large companies are using now, which basically it's part of the employee training programs that they have maybe online or whatever, that basically tell the employees what they need to look out for, the whole full range of behaviors that we're concerned about, and what to do with that information.
So let's say I have a little plant. I don't know. I'm somewhere, some small town. I've got maybe 600 employees. HR's two people, maybe three. I probably don't have a legal. Security's probably gates and badges, maybe a badge reader into the facility, and I've got maybe 1 or 2 safety people. Leadership really has to be a part of this, and are those resources available even to a smaller company?
Well, I mean, the rules are the same. I mean, you have policy, you train up, you sensitize your employees, and send a message to critical personnel. The only difference is perhaps instead of a threat management team, you may have 1 or 2 individuals that are kind of primarily responsible. And bottom line is that what they need to know is know who their resources are. When they do have an issue, to call, you may want to call someone like myself as a threat assessment consultant, or, you know, if you need to bring in legal, you know, they probably have contracted legal and bring in, but at least know what the resources are, because the process is the same. You know, like if you have a high risk employee that you're about to fire that you think, you know, can act out, then you need to stop that and start a process where you start this threat assessment process. And you need to call a professional who does this, and then you call a professional who does it. But at least somebody in the organization who knows what to do, as opposed to let's just fire them and hope nothing bad happens.
So how
or put a guard in front of the next 2 days.
Right, right. How do I contact you if I want to? What's your company's name and how do I get a hold of you?
Well, my company is Critical Response Associates. You can go online, craorg.com. I have no idea what our telephone number is.
That's fine. They're probably good with the internet, so that's good. Critical Response Associates, and it's craorg.com. Okay, so let me ask this question. What's the craziest thing you've ever seen?
So did this include all the times we've traveled together?
No, it can't include me. No craziness including me.
Oh, gosh. I'm going to have to go down the list, and that eliminates the top 10.
Aren't there any funny ones? Don't you have any good funny ones?
Funny stories? Oh, gosh, Todd.
It's too hard of a question.
It is. It is. You know, I have stories that end up not being as tragic as we thought they would be. how bad is that?
That's pretty good.
Not a positive story, but one that ended up not negative.
No, that's probably a good answer. Did we cover it all? Is that a pretty good introduction to what you do? Did we miss anything?
I think we did a good job. I think that this is a new role for you. You need to have some kind of show on one of the major networks.
Yeah, maybe I can get on, I don't know, something. I'll find maybe one of the TV news things. They always need content.
Oh, you know, Jon Stewart's leaving.
Jon, that'd be great.
See you around.
Have fun, man. Thanks for your time. It was amazing. You were great.
Thank you, Todd. See ya.
Okay. Wow, there's Mark McElhaney, Dr. McElhaney. So I owe you a story. I'm on my way to the post office, so I don't have a lot of time, so I'm not going to screw around with this one. But I promised you a story, and so now I'm going to give it to you. So Mark and I first worked together more than 10 years ago. I bet 15 years ago. And we were both working as consultants with a major large drink manufacturer located in Atlanta. I think it's probably as safe as possible. And we had to go to New York City to do a workshop on performance reliability. And my flight was late, and I was supposed to get in at 7 o'clock p.m., and it was a big mess. And the senior vice president in charge of sort of reliability for this major drink company kept telling me, you're really going to like this guy. You've got to get together. You guys are the saints, and you're going to love each other. So they finally got us together. We're in some little pub in New Jersey. It was kind of in a basement, if I remember correctly. And they set us at one end of a table, and everybody sat at the other end of the table, and they were talking, and lots going on. And so I'm trying to make conversation, and I never know where to start. Mark seemed like a nice enough person. There was no problem there. So I said, do you like music? And he said, yes. And I said, well, what kind of music do you listen to? And he said, you won't know the people I listen to. Like that, like, how dare you ask me? How dare you? And I said, well, try me. Maybe I will. And he says, well, I'm really, really currently listening a lot to a Texas songwriter that I find very, very talented, very, very good. And I said, oh, really? A Texas songwriter? Try me. And he said, well, I don't think you'd know. And I said, is his name Guy Clark? And that moment in time, that brief split second, we became fast friends and have stayed that way for almost 20 years. Mark's probably the best in the business. I don't know what would cost you to have that 30-minute consultation we just had with him, but it would be a big deal. And people would have to fly to places and go to meetings and wear ties. But we just got to hang with him. And we got to hang with the true Mark, and I think he had lots and lots to say to us. I hope this challenges you to think about how our field really reaches out and touches even beyond where we are. That's the podcast for today. Thank you for listening. Please, 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 please tell your friends. Subscribe, because that makes a huge difference. Do me a favor. Learn something new every day. Have a ton of fun. And for goodness sakes, be safe. It's kind of more meaningful after that podcast, wouldn't you agree?